Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and joining me today is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, hotel booking sites told to sort themselves out by the competition watchdog. But one woman, she sat in this studio, doesn't mind the pressure sell. Also today, whisper it softly, but we have some exciting news for savers, including from something called Marcus. It's a bank, but don't be fooled by the friendly sounding name. Plus, raffling home, are we bored with this latest quirky idea already? How much do you really need to save for retirement? Does having a figure in mind help you get there? And the winners and the losers of the World Cup are not only those on the pitches of Russia. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Right, your last chance to listen. Download right now. There is at least one other person listening to this podcast. Maybe you get the message. And now it seems so too has the competition's watchdog. Not about podcasts, I might add, but about hotel booking websites. Now, the Competition and Markets Authority has been investigating a number of issues, including these sorts of pressure sales tactics, over the last 9 months. And it seems they're sufficiently unhappy to issue legal warnings, but they aren't naming names. So, firstly, I'm just going to come to you, Lee, about these websites. Why do people use them? Like, what are they?
Well, people these days like to have a look at a hotel that they're going to book online first because they like to look at the reviews. They like to, you know, see what deals they can get out there by looking at different comparison websites and hoping to, you know, get it at the best possible price. And that's what consumers like to do. And there's lots of these websites about. Some of them are major websites. They advertise heavily.
So we're talking about things like, and these are not the ones named. I'm just naming these as examples. Sort of hotel.com,
yeah,
booking.com, Trivago.
Exactly, those, yeah. The ones that you would have heard of and you would have seen advertised, you know, quite a lot. And it's not, you know, it is hotel booking websites, but there's other industries that do this. I'm thinking of airlines, for example, that make you feel like you've got to book it now. It's the last room available. It's the last seat available. And that sort of thing the competition watchdog has been looking at.
Yeah, and specifically, Rachel, I mean, this all centred, I think, back last year when the Competition Markets Authority, now they've been looking at comparison websites generally, and I suppose these come under that umbrella, and they wanted to look more specifically. So I think it was in October they opened this investigation, looking at Lee just said there, things like five other people are looking at this right now, buy now, questions around, is this really a sale? How do these rooms get up to the top? Do they act in the best way of the consumer? Because what is it, 70% of us use these sites?
Exactly. Huge number use them. So you have to know that consumers can trust them. And that's what the Competition and Markets Authority, the CMA, was looking into, including, as you say, the ranking. Lots of these sites will sort hotels, first of all, according to your specification, but after that, if there are a bunch that meet them, then they have to decide what order to put them in. And generally, they'll give you the options to put it, you know, distance from a particular location where you want to be, or price, or something like that. But then they'll also have, the default might be something a little bit more ambiguous, like best selling or recommended or best deals, and you never quite know what that is, but there is a suggestion that what it may be related to is how much commission that website is getting. And then if you think about the impact of that, they know that most of us might scroll down 3, 5, 7, but you're not going to go to page 3, are you, of the search options?
I'm quite fussy. This is probably where you're going to talk about the pressure selling, because sometimes you do need a bit of a kick up there.
That's true. We'll talk about this.
We will do. But actually, this is important because it sort of goes to the heart of how they work. So this is not it's not a charity or anything like that. You go in and it is free for you to use. But because it's free, they get their money somehow. How they get their money is because they charge, I assume, some money from the hotels.
Exactly. Right. They take a cut of your booking from the hotel. And presumably, the higher up in the rankings they are, in a sense, potentially the more they've spent. And it's not like the hotel's going to pay for this out of some other sort of pot. They will pay for it from the money that you've just paid. So are you getting the best deals when you pick the ones that are, you know, promoted at the top? It's not clear that you are. So that's one thing that they're looking into. Another thing is this countdown thing, as you say. The fear is that people might rush into booking things needlessly, because there are 50,000 people looking at the one place that they might want for that one night. And
in the middle of nowhere, out of season, isn't that crazy how many people are looking exactly the same time as you?
Quite. But then, I mean, they do say lots of them have customers that go into the millions. Generally, they don't claim that nine people are booking now. They'll say nine people are looking now, which is quite different. Mm. And when they say looking, are they saying looking at your dates and that room that you want? They're not really specifying that either. So when you see nine people are looking, it's a very sort of loose, I think, definition of that, and not necessarily showing intent of all of those people to purchase the same room as you at that time.
So there's lots of issues that the CMA has been looking at, and fast forward to now, what have they done? What have they found? Because they're not actually saying who they've sent out letters to.
No. So this often happens that they won't name, and I think their...
Why?
I think that their objective is to get things changed, and if they can do that by writing strongly worded letters mm-hmm. to the companies involved, then maybe that's enough. And if it's not, then maybe naming and shaming is the next thing to do. But at the moment, it seems that that is the option that they're going for.
But they do have the power to threaten legal action if they don't change. Is that right?
They've threatened it. Yeah, they've threatened it if there isn't a change. But
and then they can fine them, presumably, if they're found...
Yeah, as watchdogs go, the CMA has slightly sharper teeth, I think, than others. So yes, it does have powers to go further if it decides that that's warranted.
I like things like this, I have to say, because I do think it raises awareness around how these models work. Mm-hmm. And I think we do, all of us, have a responsibility for our own finance. If you're happy to go on these sites, you know how they work, you know that maybe you could get a better deal, but you know you can't be bothered with the hassle, mm-hmm. then great. And actually a lot of competition, I imagine, has been able to come onto the market as a result of these. There are good things about them.
There's good and bad about these websites, Georgia. Exactly what you're saying there. And it's a great way to be able to compare and look at ratings and sit all under one roof rather than having to go on every individual hotel website. But these booking websites do wield a lot of power. And ooh, let's yeah. think about it. If you're a hotelier and you're not on, you know, one of these big websites now, the so many, you know, 70% of people are using them, you're missing out potentially on, and they know that, these hotel booking websites. They know they've got you in the palm of your hand, and you will pay to get onto these listing websites. And it's not, that necessarily isn't very good for the consumer. But I've been...
And if you're a small boutique, it must be really hard. That commission must bite a lot more than, you know, if you're a massive hotel chain.
Exactly. But there is something that you can do. And this, I've been doing this for a very long time. I'd written a column about this last year, because it's one of those things you think, oh, I reckon everyone probably does this. But then, actually, do they? So I thought, well, it's, you know, interesting enough topic to write something about. So last year, I was actually having a conversation with a friend, and I said, I always contact the hotel directly. So I'll use a hotel comparison website, I'll see the price, and I will contact the hotel directly and say, look, this is the price I've seen on this website. We're cutting out the middleman here, so you must be able to either give it to me slightly cheaper or give me a room upgrade or some other perks. Georgie, it works like 95% of the time. It's incredible. And actually, a lot of even some of the big hotel chains are trying to get themselves away from that kind of model of going onto those listing websites by incentivizing you to come and book direct. And that probably shows you the percentage that these booking websites might be taking.
So that's one really great tip. Either, you know, call them direct or go onto their website to find out whether you can get it cheaper. I have one experience of that, and it's probably quite rare, where I called the hotel directly and I did exactly what you said. I probably had read your article, because it was about this time last year when I booked it. And they said, no, I'm sorry, we don't take any bookings unless it's through these websites.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Isn't that interesting? But there are things you can do. Do go onto things like TripAdvisor. Take a look at what people say really about the hotel.
And also, I mean, you go onto these websites, and they quite often pay to get themselves at the top, as we were saying. Mm. You want to get onto that little search bar and do it by price or do it by customer rating.
Yep.
You know, instead of getting
location,
manipulated.
Do you want a swimming pool? All of your stipulations, make sure
all of those sort of things. Yeah. But I mean, going back to that booking direct thing, I've got a couple of really good examples of how it's worked for me. So my fiance and I, we went down to Brighton a couple of years ago. It was on the whim. We landed home from Morocco at Gatwick. We were like, let's just keep the holiday going. Let's go to Brighton.
That's nice.
So we got the train to Brighton. Obviously didn't have a hotel booked. And now Danny and my other half, she's absolutely brilliant at this sort of thing. And she's like haggle queen. I love it. So she's looking up the prices on, you know, online. She sees this B&B, likes the look of it. She's phoning up the guy going, like, this is the price, it's last minute, who else is going to be booking this room? You know, giving it all of that spin. I think we ended up getting it for a good £30-40 under what was on the booking website. Because, you know, the power is in your hands. You know, you could just pay that, or you could phone up and say, do you know what?
How many other hotels are there in Brighton that I could go to?
I did it last year as well at an awards do in London. So I was kind of like, I'd had a couple of glasses of bubbly and I thought, no, do you know what? I fancy just staying in London, not worrying about commuting back to Essex. Saw this hotel and I honestly just phoned him up and he was like, yeah, I'll do it for you, half price, bring cash. I was like, brilliant. Yeah, it sounds a bit
dodgy.
But it was a fine hotel and it worked out. So I think that you're right, you just got to do your homework. You know, just don't rely on these websites to do it all. And actually, the one other thing I was going to mention about this is, I won't name which company it is, but there's one big website that, for whatever reason, I must have booked something with them before, so they've got my email address. I find it very, very creepy when I'm looking at going to a destination, let's say I'm going to Dublin and I'm looking at some hotels, and then I don't book anything because it's just to get an idea and a flavour of prices and whatnot. And then about half an hour later, I'll get an email to my Hotmail account saying, are you still thinking about your Dublin trip? And they do that to absolutely anywhere that I look. And then you have all the tracking cookies on the advertising when you're going around different websites. I don't like that very much. It actually makes me not want to use that website because it feels like you are bombarding me with...
Yeah, I don't like that either.
It's not a good way to run a business. That is not going to bully me into booking with that company.
But clearly, though, lots of these tactics do work.
Well, they must do, otherwise they wouldn't do it.
Exactly, yeah. They wouldn't put their resources into doing these tactics. But Rachel, you've written an article where you actually sort of defend them.
I do not enjoy using them, but it's like taking cod liver oil or something. I feel like ultimately it does me good and doesn't matter that it's not a pleasurable experience. So I went to a talk by two people. I think it was from one of the websites. I think it was booking.com, at a wonderful festival called Nudgestock, which is a festival of behavioural science organised by Rory Sutherland at Ogilvy. They talked through the typical process of booking a hotel online pre these sorts of websites. And the way it goes is that you decide that you're going somewhere, maybe you book your flights, and then you sort of look speculatively at hotel rooms, and then you get distracted, and you have a few ideas, maybe you send them around to the other people in your party, wait for them to get back to you. They do maybe a fortnight later, and it drags on, and then suddenly you think, we're going next week, we've got nowhere to stay, and kick yourself because you knew a long time ago that you were going to go and you knew what those dates were and yet you didn't book. And then when you go back to book the initial place that you had first been thinking about, of course it's gone and you end up with somewhere else that's more expensive or inferior. And so the whole process around booking.com, all those different nudges, are designed to thwart that inertia.
Oh, so it's to help us.
So to get you, once you've largely committed to going to a particular destination, then it will try to do everything it can to get you to do it as soon as possible. And, you know, the fear of missing out, that really is a great motivator. So telling you that the hotel rooms might not be there next week can really help you. And sometimes I really appreciate that because when I look back and I think, what were you doing? You knew that you were going to go on this particular trip and yet you didn't book. And now it's more expensive. It's usually frustrating. And I think it's different from other types of panic buying or rushing you into making purchases. Because generally, when you are at the point that you're considering booking a hotel room, you have booked flights or you've committed to, it's very hard to do these sorts of things totally on a whim. So I think it's less of a kind of impulse buy than, say, something that using the same tactics to make you try and buy, I don't know, a dress or something superfluous that you absolutely don't need. It's harder, I think, to impulse buy hotel rooms.
Maybe. But this is where the issue and the argument with behavioural economics and that fine line it treads as to how much of it is just giving us a wee nudge and how much of it is really shoving us into making a decision that we don't really want to do or haven't really thought about long enough to make a decision.
It's true. I mean, I'd be interested to know if people do end up buying hotel rooms on whims that they never even wanted or needed as a result of these sorts of tactics, or whether it does just help to nudge people into doing what they probably want to do.
When I have an exam, I felt a little bit under pressure. To be fair, I'd only given myself 36 hours to fly on holiday. I like going on a whim. And I ended up getting a hotel. It was fine. It was fine. Had I given myself perhaps a little bit more time to look around, I might have got something that's a little bit more suitable, a little bit nicer, but it was fine. I'm not blaming the booking website for it. It was for me. It was just okay. But the thing, like, normally, if I don't book a holiday, Rachel, within 36 hours, I will spend more time. And what I find works the other way for me with this pressure selling is I panic. And I can't make a decision. It's like three people looking at this, but there's three people looking at this. There is one tip that you can do, which is if you order the hotel and you don't pay for it up front and you get that free cancellation, if the price does drop, well, of course, you can just cancel it and you can rebook it.
That's very true. The free cancellation actually on some of those websites is one of the big attractions of actually sometimes using those hotel booking websites, because if you go directly with the hotel, often it's non-refundable. Sometimes these booking websites have a special deal where actually it works for quite a lot of people, because you book it and you don't have to pay until you're there or a couple of days before. You might not necessarily get that if you go direct, but that's why you should weigh up all the options and see if it's worth paying a little bit less, but it might not be refundable.
So in sum, Rachel, what happens next?
We'll have to see what modifications are made and whether the Competition and Markets Authority is happy with that. I think that so long as we know what we're getting into, so long as it's transparent, then I don't really have a problem with a lot of the tactics. And ultimately, things like discounts you have to take with a pinch of salt and just decide what is good value for you. Is that a price that you're willing to pay? And if it is, it doesn't matter whether it's 40% off or it's, you know, more expensive than last week. If it has value to you, then you go for it, and don't get too confused by the popularity of different places or rankings of people who you may not share the same values with.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, when you think of the name Marcus, what does it conjure up? Well, for me, it's the Caesar in Gladiator, or the kooky kid in the film about a boy. Actually, I also have a cousin called Marcus. Not a bank, though, but it's true. There is a bank called Marcus in the US, and it's gone down something of a storm, and it's heading our way. But what may surprise even more is that this friendly, non-threatening, personably named bank, Marcus, is actually an offshoot of possibly the scariest bank out there, Goldman Sachs. Now, that's a name synonymous with the subprime mortgage crisis. And is this rightly the sacking of the bottom 10% of staff just because it can? So could Marcus prove a hit on this side of the pond, shake up the savings market and not be super scary? Lee, tell us a little bit more.
Well, Georgie, actually, I just thought this podcast, I wanted to get a little bit of savers of banking shoehorned in. I feel like it's sort of fallen off the agenda a little bit. So I went out there in the last sort of week or two and I found some interesting things that are going on.
You've got a lot here coming up.
Got a lot coming up.
So pace yourself, Lee.
So, Marcus, it sounds, as you say, very friendly. And it's following a trend at the moment, I think, of financial firms just using a name. Do you know what I mean? Because it sounds quite, there's my bank, Marcus. But it does. It sounds quite friendly. Do you know what I mean?
It's behavioural economics type thing.
I reckon it quite possibly is. Oh, I'm just giving 50 quid to Marcus this month. Yeah, but you can see people doing it. Anyway, Goldman Sachs, it's their new online offshoot bank. So it's going to be online only. Going to offer savings accounts over here. I'm told later in the summer. I haven't got a precise date. I pushed them on that. I didn't know. Now, Goldman Sachs, it's the fifth biggest bank in the US. And since it's launched there, it's looked to get some of the deposits of the American market, and they've made it quite accessible to the whole of the country. Think about how vast America is and all the different states and all the different banking laws out there. They've managed to sort of launch some fixed rates and some easy access savings accounts out there. And they've got $22 billion of deposits in 18 months. I mean, that is sizable. That's a lot of money being poured into there. I had a dig around the US websites. They are offering best buys in pretty much all categories. And this is like almost 2 years after they launched. So you think, well, hold on, if they're still doing that, you know what happens with some of these challenger banks, Georgie? They come in, They want the cash quickly. They go top of the Best Buy charts and you never see them ever again to the top because they get the money that they need.
And then boom, 2 days later, they're off.
They're off, exactly.
But so when you say about things like challengers, when you've got Goldman's behind it with 20 billion or whatever, this is like, yowch.
Yeah, this is why I think banking in Britain is quite interesting though, because you've got all of these different challenger banks at the moment, and some of them are startups, some of them have been funded in other ways. As there's a lot of challengers coming out doing different things, and we'll talk a little bit about Monzo a little bit later in the show. But I think that Marcus is probably going to be quite popular here if it offers good rates, because, all right, Goldman Sachs may not be the most popular bank in the world. And we remember those days in the financial crisis when staff were coming out with their boxes out of the building and all sorts, you know, of horrible things happening at that time. But that said, Britons and their savings, they like to get the best rates that they possibly can. And Goldman Sachs, they'll probably see it as a trusted brand. And instead of... Sometimes there's that worry with a startup that things might go a bit pear-shaped. You know, of course, Goldman Sachs could go pear-shaped. You would never have thought it before the financial crisis. I mean, it's the fifth biggest US bank. But Marcus actually is named after the founder, German guy that moved to America, 1848. So it's named after Marcus Goldman.
Which is
a nice little touch. So we'll see what rates are going to be offered here. We don't quite know the details just of yet, but... Our sort of feeling is that they're going to do some good rates. They've got some good backing behind it.
Well, we actually, Lee, when we've been seeing Best Buy fixed rate savings accounts, we're just sticking with some positive news in this area, which you rightly said we haven't had a lot of late. Mm-hmm. And they've hit levels not seen for more than 2 years. Now, this is according to a new index from the independent advice website Savings Champion. Tell us a bit more about this.
Well, this is
tough times over, Lee?
Well, the tough times are definitely not over for savers, Georgie, I'm afraid. There's still way many two things going on that mean that rates aren't really going to go anywhere near they were, you know, in sort of 2012 or so. But Savings Champion, I've got this index, like a monthly index. Yeah, actually, they update this every day, so it's a rolling daily effort. Wow. It shows what the top five Best Buy rates are for 1, 2, 3, and 5 year fixed rates. And the data shows they're all on their way up, and they are back to levels not seen since the start of 2016, which is good news for savers. I mean, these rates aren't earth-shattering, and we're coming from a time when people are still remembering sort of before 2012, when rates were sort of, you know, you could get 4%, and that was just a normal fixed rate account. 1 year fixed now, it's ticked over 2% again, so you can get 2.05% with Atom Bank. And there's a raft of fairly decent deals in the longer term fixed rate categories as well. Tough times are definitely not over, though. I mean, it is very difficult still for savers who are risk averse, who perhaps don't want to get involved in investing. They want their money to be, you know, protected under the FSCS scheme up to £85,000 per banking license. And, you know, to do that, they use savings accounts, you know, from a variety of household names, challengers and startups and so on. And actually, I think we'll be talking about the tough times being over when more big high street banking names get involved in the savings market, because at the moment, what's happened is they've all just left. It's very, very difficult to get a good rate from the big banking boys. Now, we did have a couple of rates in the last few months. Nationwide did a fairly good ISA, which it's since pulled. Halifax had a Best Buy rate, which we hadn't seen for I don't know how long, and that's since been pulled because obviously got in the money that they needed. So there's still a lot to go on and a lot to happen. But the interesting thing is that there are a lot of challenges in the pipeline ready to compete for cash. The thing is with savings rates, it's very difficult. So if I tell a friend in their 30s and they go, what's the best savings account? You say what the rate is and how much they get on their money, and they go, oh, I mean, that's awful. But, you know, you have to look at it on the other side of the fence as well. Of course, a lot of savers don't have a mortgage because they might be mortgage-free by now. You know, a lot of older people, you know, who tend to be savers. But also, if you have got a mortgage at the moment, for example, you know, rates have been rock bottom for the last 5-7 years. And if you're feeling a little bit like, oh, savings rate's a bit bad, you can always overpay the mortgage, you know, a little bit. You could up your pension contributions. It's always a good thing to do. There's other ways to make hay while perhaps savings rates aren't shining. But, you know, we'll see if they start nudging higher. And if they do, it'd be good news.
And you said it's older people, but what about people wanting to get on the property ladder? Say you've put your £4,000 max into your LISA, you want to save somewhere else, you don't want to put it into investment because you know that's all for the long term. Mm-hmm. You know, people need these sort of cash savings
spots. And they rely on that. You know, these, for example, easy access. So we've talked about fixed rate. Easy access savings rates have been absolutely dire. I mean, so dire. You can just about get over 1% with them. And that's how a lot of people like to hold their cash, you know, because you might need it to buy a house. You know, things might happen quickly. If you've got it locked away for a year or two, well, if you touch that money, A, you really probably can't get it out. B, you'd lose interest, any kind of interest on it anyway. So it would have been no point of putting it there. So you are right. And I'd like to see a few easy access rates come to the plate, because they're just bread and butter accounts for people. And going back to Marcus, they said to me that it's more likely that they're going to launch an easy access over fixed rates to begin with. So that might indicate that we could have a new Best Buy easy access rate on the horizon.
We got a new offering as well, Lee, from Virgin Money. Just quickly on that one.
Yes, this is it's a little bit complicated to explain. But I like to see providers when they do something a little bit different, even if it might not necessarily be...
I'm not a big fan of the gimmicks. You like the gimmicks?
I don't know if you can call this that much of a gimmick. You're still getting something fairly good for your money. But the trouble is, if you've got...
tell us what it is, Lee. Well, come on.
Right, so Virgin have launched a one-year fixed savings account. But instead of getting paid money as your interest, you get paid air miles with Virgin Atlantic. We had a look. You have to have sort of that 20,000, 25,000 points to fly to sort of the States. And this is off-peak to India and UAE and things. But as Rachel rightly pointed out to me, it's all well and good. But, you know, you have to still pay the taxes and pay the airline fees and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And they can mount up to a couple of £100 anyway. So basically, they're offering... for every £1,000 that is saved, you get 1,400 flying club miles. So it sounds pretty good on paper. I kind of crunched the maths on it and I'm not convinced it's really that good a deal. But it's like we were saying earlier about the hotel websites. You've got to crunch all these figures. And if it's something that you know, perhaps you've already got some of these miles and you want to bump up the miles, it might be worth doing.
Is it right for you? And that's with all of these things.
It's exactly. And actually... for why I think it's probably not right for most people is the fact that if you've got a lump sum of that kind of magnitude, you'd be much better off putting it into like a normal fixed rate account and then just buying the flights probably separately anyway and with any airline rather than just being restricted to Virgin Atlantic. So it's an interesting one. Virgin does also launched a couple of credit cards a few months ago that offer air miles. So actually Virgin Money and Virgin Atlantic never really worked together before, so it's been this year that they've kind of started to do it. But if I was someone looking at this, I would go on this website, see how many points you need for somewhere that you want to go, have a look at what flights are available and what the fees and the surcharges are, because it might not make it worthwhile. I know a lot of people do use these sort of things for sort of like a business upgrade and that sort of thing. And then use our lump sum calculator. So let's say you had £20,000, throw that in with the interest rate that you could get at Best Buy and see how much that would leave you after a year. And it might end up being a better deal anyway.
I don't think I've ever flown Virgin in my life.
I was going to actually just add to that. Air France and KLM are going to be in this flying club membership from next year. So starting next year, that will mean... obviously, at the moment, Virgin Atlantic only does long haul, but Air France and KLM do short haul. So there might be a possibility, Rachel, that you might be able to use your points next year to go somewhere that's not really far away and won't have huge air passenger duty fees.
And I think I might have flown Air France once. You never know. Maybe I'll get it. Finally, Lee, you've been a busy boy. You mentioned Monzo a short time ago. They're all the rage. Even my mates who were not engaged in money were flashing these brightly coloured cards everywhere. But it seems, though, it got a full banking licence, didn't it, a year ago. And it's not looked that rosy because... is it right to say the majority of their current account holders are not using it as a main bank? So they don't have a lot of money in there.
It's been an incredible rise of this bank, Georgie, I would say. Because
it really has.
The bank card really stands out. So it's like really fluorescent. I see a lot of people using it to pay for their tube journeys in London. I think the best one was I went to this event. It was a new opening of a BrewDog pub. So the brewery. I would say that the hipsters there... at least half of them were paying contactless with their Monzo cards.
They was luminous flashing all over the place.
I couldn't help but notice it. And also, really geekily, I did a trip up north last part of last year, and I went and visited a card manufacturer. I know, yeah, I know. But Monzo cards, they said they handled Monzo cards unbelievable amount of Monzo cars compared to everything else that was being made, because yeah. the demand is obviously there, and it's a place that people want to try.
But
and
why anyway, people liked it though in the first place? Why did it really caught people's imagination, but not so much it being a bank account, but what it could do, the sort of budgeting side of it?
There's a budgeting side of it, and also you could free withdrawals in Europe. I mean, that's a very expensive thing to offer. Mm. We've seen it in the past with other banks. Metro Bank do still offer that, but I mean, Metro Bank used to do it for worldwide. It's a great way to sign up customers, that, because people, you know, often go on holiday, don't know the best way to get money out, don't want to get stung with fees of their own bank, so it's a good thing to offer. But obviously that comes at a cost, and what a lot of people do with these sort of accounts is don't use it as their primary account. They open up, test it out, use it for Europe, put a bit of money in it, probably forget about it until their next holiday. So we've had some figures from Monzo. Doesn't make great reading. It's going to be losses. It's very expensive to start up a bank.
I think it's just a matter of time as well, because of it's just change of mindset, isn't it?
Yeah, it's imagine starting up a bank from scratch. It's a very hard thing to do.
I can't, Lee. Is that, but, I haven't thought about it. And
get yourself into the mindset. But if you think about it, there's so many costs that you don't think about and hurdles that you've got to jump just to get a banking license, let alone get the ability of getting 1 million current account customers. Mm. But these figures showed that losses have quadrupled to £33 million in the year to February 2018, which... it's kind of like, well, it's all venture capitalist money, you know, you got to speculate to accumulate, yeah, type thing. So I can kind of understand that. And actually, going back to the Metro Bank example, Monzo doesn't have a branch network. It's just an online only bank. And obviously Metro have gone sort of big on, mm, you know, branches and things. I mean, we kept on at Metro for a number of years that it wasn't making a profit. And now it's sort of finally starting to become profitable. That's taken a good 6 or 7 years. So, you know, it's easy to go, oh, look at those losses. It's absolutely unbelievable. But, I mean, they've just launched current accounts. They've done
only a year.
Exactly.
I mean, that's
and
not
they've
long.
Got almost a million current account customers.
Yeah.
That is incredible. But the big, big, big but is the worry over people not using it as a primary account. It's £150 average, yeah, in the accounts held. That's very expensive to service a current account. I mean, we're quite lucky in this country because this has been this whole argument about free banking. It's not free banking, but you can have free banking if you use your current account properly. It's a difficult market to tap into. A lot of people sign up for it. Why they're not having their salaries paid in, using it as their primary account? Well, is it a kind of trust issue? Is it like they kind of want to wait a little bit of time to make sure that it's going to be a viable business, and that, you know, because the big banks in this country obviously get bashed a lot, mm-hmm, right? But most of us are with one of the big banks, and on the whole, we tend to not have too many problems with them. You know, we tend to have a current account, it tends to we get our money paid in, we take our money out. You know, we obviously it doesn't always happen like that, and some things go wrong and whatnot. But I think a lot of people just get really worried about switching as well, and it's kind of to switch your whole. All of your direct debits, all that sort of thing. Even though we've got the 7-day switching guarantee service, which,
yeah,
which by the way, which
amazing.
Is great,
yeah.
Used it, it's great. People are still a little bit hesitant about it.
I don't know if it's nerves, or maybe you just think, well, they're all much of a muchness. And I also think with this one in particular, and perhaps the difference with Metro, is there's something to be said about, and I know the cutting bank branches all left, right and sundry, but there's something to be said about having something physical. I don't know, for me, it would be a complete mind shift. And that's going to take time, I think. While we probably will end up all being online and doing a banking online, mm-hmm, and actually you don't go into a bank, it's just nice to know there's something physical there, and you know it's got that history and it's got that presence.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Georgie, because obviously a lot of these bank branches and things are getting cut. And actually another thing I did in the last couple of weeks is I visited the new Halifax. It's on Tottenham Court Road. It's a new flagship branch. It's the biggest bank branch in Britain. It's 13,500 square foot.
Wow.
So it's a huge... It's in an old Dorothy Perkins Burton retail shop. Mm. Slap bang outside of Tottenham Court Road Station, all of that new redevelopment. And you're thinking, well, hold on a minute. You're cutting all these branches. But you must have spent absolute millions opening that. So I think that a lot of banks are starting to realise now they're trimming and trimming and trimming these branches. I'm not sure how much more trimming can be done. And actually, I can see some more of these sort of mega branches coming up, because, all right, let's say there was 4 or 5 Halifax branches in central London. They've all closed. You know, that is a tragedy. But then they open like a big one and everyone can kind of get to it still within sort of 10, 15 minutes. Obviously, this is only for cities and things.
Yeah.
But then people in rural communities, I noticed on the story I'd written, you know, that could have probably opened 10 branches in rural communities, but then doesn't have the footfall.
Doesn't pack a bigger punch, though, does it, PR-wise, stepping out of Tottenham Court Road? Wow, no, what an advert.
And also, I totally agree with you, by the way, I wouldn't be fully comfortable not having a branch. Like, I don't use it that often.
Psychological thing, I think.
I don't bank on my phone. I don't really like it. I've never enjoyed banking on my phone. I like to do it online, so, you know, actually in front of a computer. But, you know, sometimes you'll get a check. You know, you still get checks. Some companies still pay by check. And I go in and pay my check in at the branch. I don't really know. Okay, you can now scan it on your phone and all that sort of thing. But I like to know it's there. And yeah. I don't know why, Georgie. I don't know why I like to know it's there. I just do.
Rachel?
It's so interesting watching this all play out. And I wonder whether we'll see a similar kind of cycle as we have with supermarkets and grocery shopping, whereby it's forecast that people are going to be doing all of their banking online on their phones. We don't need branches. Cull. They end up these, as you say, these massive branches, the big ones here and there, much as we've seen with supermarkets. They used to have little shops on high streets. Then we ended up with these massive superstores. And then at some point, with supermarkets certainly, it was recognised that it's not very convenient going out of your way to go to a big place, and it's not fun, and you don't necessarily want to get your coffee and have your kids play in a bank. And so then what we've seen with supermarkets is the big dash for the convenience store model. So just little places conveniently placed with useful opening hours. So I think all of this is still really finding its feet, and there'll be a lot of changes and different iterations before it settles down. But it's interesting to think about where, as you say, the online cousins will fit into all of this. And with Monzo, my fear is that a lot of the stuff that people like them for is the things that is going to end up holding them back financially. Mm. So as you say, people don't want it as their main current account, perhaps because they're worried about switching to a purely online only, but also because it's really nice having two. I've been thinking about opening one for exactly that reason, that to have a separate fund for discretionary spending to allow you to better manage that portion of your spending, and with your big outcomings coming out of your main current account. It's really good for budgeting. I know lots of people who do it that way. It's also good for group budgeting. All of this stuff is brilliant. That's why people like it. It's also probably one of the things that is going to be most expensive for the bank longer term. So how they come up with a business model that doesn't use the same tactics that some of the traditional banks have been attacked for, like overdraft fees, all those sorts of things, all the things that people don't like about banking. How do you create a model that people like that doesn't rip people off without charging them anything for it? It's really hard.
Right, once and for all, how much do we need to be saving for retirement? Because according to the latest gloomy report, telling us we are not saving enough and we're all going to die poor and miserable, once final salary schemes are gone, they're extinct, just 3% of savers in modern schemes will be able to afford what is now considered a comfortable retirement. So 97% of us are stuffed. But how much is enough? And does having a figure in mind, and I read an article about this recently, does having a sort of set number help us to achieve that target, do you think, Rachel?
This is a really difficult thing to reconcile. That one, it is very hard to come up with that number because you have to know things like how long you're going to live for, when you might be able to retire, and you know, whether you want to have holidays with fish and chips in Brighton.
Well, that's it. What's considered a comfortable retirement?
Exactly, and it really varies from person to person. So then coming up with rules is really hard to do. At the same time, that may be one of the things that helps people to really focus on saving. When it's a sort of hypothetical, arbitrary, unknown number, it's very hard to relinquish day-to-day things for that amorphous, strange amount that you may or may not need. So maybe it's better, is the argument in this report, to do more like how you have in Australia, and you have different targets for the type of retirement that you might want to have. And it's a total fudge, really, because no one knows, but maybe that's better than nothing. So we have lots of different sort of rules of thumbs about how much you're supposed to save. This report says
12%
of your salary.
Which auto-enrolment doesn't quite cut it, does it?
Nowhere near.
Right, yeah.
Other rules of thumb are things like half your age at the point at which you start to save. That can
work. That percentage
work.
You have to put in, yeah.
Yeah. But really, who knows? And this all sort of goes under the assumption as well that there will be a state pension that will be the kind of bedrock of your retirement spending, on top of which you can add your own for whatever it is. This may or may not exist for future generations. So that, again, is really unknown.
Right, so 97% of us are all stuffed. Right, imagine paying... Well, this will be good news, though, if you can get this. Imagine paying just a fiver for a house, and not a doll's house either, a real one. And that was what was being promised by the owners of a house in Brixton in South London. They were raffling tickets to win their property. Now, the problem is... Well, not too many people were as enthused by the idea as you might think. The deadline's now been extended several months late because insufficient tickets were sold. No one wants a house for a fiver. We buy lottery tickets for that.
I found this absolutely hilarious and I don't know why.
I remember us talking about this when it came on and you were not sure whether that was quite what the house should be worth, but be that as it may, still a house in South London.
That's the thing, isn't it? And actually, London house prices have been sort of falling a little bit in the last 12 to 18 months. So I'm not sure it was the best time to launch one in London. But it's an interesting concept, right? So we've seen this in the last couple of years, people trying to raffle off their homes, especially big estate, you know, big stately manor houses, that sort of thing, that they just can't shift because a lot of bedrooms, a lot of upkeep, you know, probably need repairs. So anyway, that's been, there's been a lot of stories about that sort of thing. Now, a lot of people falling foul of the rules on this when you list a property and then subsequently have had to cancel the raffle because they haven't, you know, there's all sorts of strict gambling laws around it. So, you know, when you get asked like a silly question, you know, when you see it on TV, you know, this morning and that sort of thing, you know, what is the capital of England?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. They have to ask that question because there has to be a sort of element of like skill to it. So this company, it's called Raffle House. It's quite interesting. I've set up a platform, pretty sound idea. You can make sure the regulations are correct.
Stick
a fiver on it and people will probably catch the imagination. People will go, well, you know, this is an actual company trying to do it rather than just like some individuals doing it. Now, the house went live in April to buy tickets and it had a deadline of mid-June. It had to sell 150,000 tickets. If not enough tickets were sold, they were going to do a raffle for the money instead, right? So anyway, I thought I'd chase them up, see what was going on with it. Deadline had passed. Hadn't seen any sort of, here's the new owners with the keys type thing.
Yeah.
The thing they didn't tell us is actually the flat is owned by the owner of this raffle house. They didn't actually tell us at the time because I asked the question.
Oh, hello.
Surely the sellers of the home are getting a little bit, you know, antsy because the whole idea is that you want to kind of get rid of this property quickly because it's not selling fast. So how are they, you know, actually it was it's a guy's home. So anyway, they've extended this to November. That's a long old time.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to sell enough tickets for this.
I don't know, but this sounds to me, are they really that bothered by it? Because if it's a raffle house, it does seem to me it's probably, they've got in the papers, it sounds good. Maybe I'm just being cynical,
no,
and I can be cynical.
You're correct to be cynical, Georgie.
I just think that, are they even bothered about not selling the home?
I guess one thing I'll say in defence is, you know, it's a new concept. They probably didn't quite know the quite correct value of a property to ticket ratio. It's quite a lot of things that you have to consider that you might not necessarily get right the first time, but I just don't know how interested the public are in doing it. I mean, the odds are way shorter than winning the lottery or you know, anything else, but it's just one of those things that for some reason it just hasn't seemed to have captured the imagination. You'd think 150,000 tickets.
Well, I imagine if you go into your local, I don't know, Sainsbury's and there's a big sort of box on the side when you buy your crisps and whatnot and you put a fiver in, people might be a bit more enthused
maybe,
by
maybe
it.
Maybe that's what they need to go old school. They need
you
to start getting
some
boots on the ground to start walking around.
Exactly.
The exit of a supermarket. Have you heard about this
go
raffle?
Go to your local summer church fate or
exactly,
something. You know?
Yeah, maybe
do it the proper way.
Maybe that's what they're doing, Georgie, between here and November, because I don't know how they're going to push this any further, because they obviously got an amount of press about it in April. I've done this follow-up story, but how do you from now to November get enough people to get enthused about winning a one-bedroom flat in Brixton? Maybe the key was to get a 15-bedroom house in somewhere in the middle of Wales or somewhere. Maybe that's what people actually want. They don't want a one-bed in Brixton. They want some space.
But you wait after the release of this podcast, Lee. They'll be inundated with our listeners. Rachel, your views?
My reservation would always be, so when you win something, great. If you were looking for a one-bed flat in Brixton, then that is absolutely perfect for you. You can move straight in. If, however, you're already living somewhere or you have no interest in living in a one-bed or in Brixton, that is a problem. You might expect then to sell it. But if you know that it's being raffled because there have been problems with selling it in the past, so much so that they've had to go and raffle it, then you're stuck with a property that you don't want.
House for a fiver, though. I mean, if you get it for a fiver.
Yeah, if you want it. I mean, I guess you could just sell it for considerably less, which is arguably what That's true. And I think they do pay all the fees and stamp duty and all that kind of stuff, so at least that's off. I mean, arguably, you would just have to do what the raffle people should have done in the first place and just priced the place reasonably so that there may be more interest in buying it in the first place, and flog it and end up with maybe not what the raffle people think it's worth, but still you'd probably end up one bid in Brixton for about $500,000, wouldn't you?
Where's the fun in that, though? And where's the advertising potential? Anyway, finally, we had to mention it, didn't we? The World Cup. Forget the dramas and the victories on the pitch. The real winner, the UK economy, the retail sector, and by God, it needs it. And in particular, supermarkets and pubs, apart from that pesky CO2 issue. The real losers, well, could that be borrowers? The Bank of England's chief economist, Andy Haldane, suggested that the sporting feel-good factor was the reason, well, one of the reasons behind his rate rise vote last month, with expectations his mates on the MPC could follow suit in August. So, is this likely? Lee, can a sporting event really impact a major economic issue like putting up rates?
Do you know what? Actually, there's such a feel-good factor at the moment, George, isn't there? Like, you just go down the street and everyone is just super excited about the World Cup, and it's not just been England, it's just been the World Cup. It's been fantastic. It must have been a good shot in the arm for some of these pubs, because people have really got interested in it. In terms of the rate rise, there was some economic data out that's kind of got rate watchers thinking, actually, hold on, you know, there's some more positive news coming out there. And actually, the feel-good factor, England, I've seen all sorts of figures about England. And, you know, for every goal scored, it's like another £200 million boost to the economy because people buy another pint or they buy some memorabilia or whatever. And there has been an absolute boom in flag sales.
Replica kits and all sorts. Oh. I was thinking about how many pints are sold in Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland when the goals go in against England.
Well, exactly. But, you know. So it's win-win, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But the vote this week, it was 6-3 rather than 7-2 for the MPC, which doesn't sound like an awful lot, but it was expected to be 7-2. That 6-3 has kind of got people speculating and a little bit interested. We were having this nailed on May rate, which is completely disappeared. It just sort of fizzled away, which I really enjoyed. It just fizzled out like completely. We were talking about it, it just went. And now saying August looks fairly likely that there may be a rate rise. Our readers want a rate rise. We had a poll. Three quarters of our readers are saying they want a rate rise. But the whole World Cup and the England run, you'd be so surprised at what that does to the economy as a whole, and how much more people spend in the supermarket, how much more people just spend in general. It's just a feel-good factor, like clothes thing. You know, just you don't really think about it.
But pints are up like 50% in pubs and all. I'll
tell you the story from when I watched the penalty. I didn't watch the penalty shootout against Colombia in the week, Georgie.
Did you have your hands over your eyes, Lee?
I've had my heart broken too many times from England, and we went to extra time. I couldn't watch it. I left my fiance watching it. She's been loving the World Cup, by the way. Not a football fan, but she's been messaging me saying, get home soon, Nigeria, Argentina's on. That sort of thing. I absolutely love it. I brought her home a wall chart and she was so happy with it. It's been great. And I think that's been, actually, it's been a really all-encompassing World Cup. I think a lot of people have been interested in it that have never been interested in it before. But outside, I sat outside. I went in my garden. I couldn't watch extra time. I obviously didn't know if it had gone to penalties or not. I turned my phone, I put music on, I put my headphones on because I could hear the pub.
Oh, wow.
It's about a 10, 15 minute walk away, but I could hear, you know, what. So I put some music on. I nodded off and whatever I was listening to had stopped. And all I heard was, it's coming up, and then beep, 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 beep from the pub. And it went on for hours. It was like 1 or 2 o'clock. It was a Tuesday night. People are going mad for it.
Lee, I tell you, you're not the only. I was watching it with my family. One of them was out in the garden, exactly doing the same as you. And I was sat there with my 90-odd-year-old grandma thinking, oh, my, I don't think she's ready for this right now. Come on, grandma, we can do this together. Oh, we got there. Rachel, have you been equally captivated? Not a famous sporting fan yourself, are you?
I've been absolutely gripped. But has that made me more inclined to go out and buy a sofa or a house
with an English flag all over it?
I don't know. I mean, I can see that it pushes up sales of football related stuff, but at the same time, surely it pushes down the sales of other stuff. If everyone is at home at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon or at the pub, yes, they're spending more on pizza and beer.
Swedish meatballs, apparently.
Yes, I really need to. Yeah.
Where's your loyalty, people?
If they're doing all of that and spending on all of that kind of stuff, then they're not down the shops on a Saturday afternoon buying the other stuff that they normally would buy. So does it really lead to a sort of an exuberance that ends up pushing into extra sales of stuff and everyone just generally spends more on everything? I don't know.
Oh, Rachel, you're gloom and doom. Come on, Lee, end us on a positive.
I don't know why I'm calling it.
Just a laugh, that big. Yeah,
no, I was going to say, I think it might just be that people just want a rate rise so much that they'll just peg it on anything. Yes. And it's like, wow, the feel-good factor, the weather's been great, the football's been great. Rates might go up. Wouldn't that be great? And I think that's maybe what's been going on.
Maybe that's in your world, Lee.
I don't know. Those savers we were talking about earlier that can't find good rates from the fixed rates accounts out there, I think they'd be cheering as much as an England World Cup win.
I don't know. I don't know whether to play our favourite game, when will rates rise, or who will win the World Cup. Let's go for both. When will rates rise, Lee?
Rates will rise around about October 2024.
Right, okay, fair enough.
AKA, I've got no idea because I don't want to play this game anymore because I'm never correct.
Table, just go. Just go. Leave the studio, Lee. Who's going to win the World Cup?
Russia.
I was about to say Russia as well. Because they are the better team out there. Rachel, I am asking you, who's going to win the World Cup?
She's like, what?
Who's going to win? The consumer economy.
That's the spirit. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.